Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the Voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello again and welcome. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington with a program that helps you learn and improve your American English. Today, we hear about the relationship between India and the United States. Are better days ahead now that an ambassador has resigned? Then, some exciting news from NASA, the U.S. space agency. If you like airplanes, you will want to hear what they are working on. You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. The resignation of the United States ambassador to India could lead to improved ties between the two countries. The resignation of Ambassador Nancy Powell came as no surprise to observers in the Indian capital, New Delhi. Ties between the countries have been tense since the arrest of an Indian diplomat in New York. Jonathan Evans tells us more.
Marie Harf is a spokesman for the U.S. State Department. On Monday, she denied that there is a connection between the diplomatic dispute and the resignation. She told reporters in Washington that Ambassador Powell was retiring after a celebrated career.
It is in no way related to any tension, any recent situations. There's no big behind-the-scenes story here.
But observers in New Delhi disagree. They say the U.S. hopes to reset relations with India over the arrest of the Indian diplomat in New York. Law enforcement officials required the diplomat to remove her clothing while they performed a body search. The Indian woman was arrested on charges of underpaying her housekeeper. The diplomat has since returned to India. Observers say the ambassador's resignation increases the possibility for business contacts with a new Indian government. However, the bigger barrier to better relations is the U.S. position on Narendra Modi. He is the prime ministerial candidate of the Bharatiya Janata Party. Studies have shown his party could win enough votes to form a new government after the Indian elections end next month. Narendra Modi has been banned from traveling to the U.S. and several other Western countries. They claim he did not do enough to stop religious riots in 2002. More than 1,000 people died in the unrest. Many were Muslims in Gujarat, his home state. But several European countries opened diplomatic contacts with Mr. Modi last year. Ambassador Powell held her first meeting with him only 6 weeks ago. Indian observers say the meeting took place too late to be effective. Chintamani Mahapatra is the chairman of the Center for U.S. and Latin American Studies at Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi. He says the United States has been slow in reaching out to the BJP leader. And he thinks some issues could have been dealt with in a better way. For example, Mr. Modi was denied a visa in 2005. Since then, no serious steps have been taken against him. Ambassador Powell will leave her position by the end of May. Observers in New Delhi hope that the new ambassador will be a strong political force and not a career diplomat like Ms. Powell. Chintamani Mahapatra is one of those observers.
This gives an opportunity for the U.S. administration to start a process by appointing an important person as an ambassador who can restore the strategic partnership between the two countries, and the interactions will be more cordial and friendly rather than exchange of bitter words.
I'm Jonathan Evans.
America's National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, is known for its work in space exploration. But aeronautics, a science that deals with airplanes and flying, is still a big part of the agency's research. NASA engineers are testing ideas that someday may help make lighter and quieter aircraft that produce less pollution. For more on the story, we turn to Bob Doty.
NASA officials would like to see better airplanes by 2030. They want planes that burn 60 to 70% less fuel, pollute less, and are quieter than 2005 models. Scientists say such goals are possible if manufacturers make changes to the design of aircraft and use lightweight materials. They also say new kinds of fuel need to be considered. NASA engineers have been testing a new design of airplane wing. The wing is made of a composite material that is lighter than the aluminum alloy now being used. Composite materials are made from two or more substances. In the future, plane wings will likely be made out of materials like this. Robert C. Scott is an aerospace engineer.
With advances in materials, advances in design analysis capability, and the need for higher efficiency, you end up with, you're driving yourself toward very lightweight designs.
Project scientist Richard Walls says one of those designs is the long truss-supported wing.
That allows you to stiffen the wing, keep the wing thin, grow the span to reduce drag.
If someone decides to build such an aircraft, he or she will be able to use the results of NASA tests. Researchers are also testing a new way of manufacturing composite materials. Instead of placing the fibers in straight lines, the material is instead placed around the points of heavy load, explains materials research engineer Karen Taminger. She also says new structural designs will help manufacturers to reduce the weight of airplanes and make them more energy efficient. Fay Collier supervises NASA's Environmentally Responsible Aviation Project. He says researchers also want to reduce the pollution that comes out of airplane engines.
We want to take advantage of alternative fuels and the emergence of alternative fuels, and we want to design advanced combustors to minimize the output of what I call oxides of nitrogen.
American scientists wanted to learn about the smoke of an airplane that burned a mixture of petroleum, an oil-based product, and an alternative-based fuel. To do this, they flew a second plane right behind the first one. Equipment on the second plane measured the percentage of pollutants contained in different fuel mixtures. Project scientist Richard Walls says the space agency is always looking for ways to improve aviation.
We hope to find technologies that we can accelerate forward through the research. But other technologies, you know, they may not be possible for 20 or 30 years. They're just an idea.
Until then, he says, there are small changes moving airplane manufacturers towards better, safer, and more efficient aircraft. I'm Bob Doty.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Are you ready for today's history lesson? On this date in 1783, American writer Washington Irving was born. Two of his best-known short stories are Rip Van Winkle and The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. And entertainer Wayne Newton celebrates his 72nd birthday today. Here is what he sounded like in 1963 when this song made him famous.
Dark as shame, darling, dark as shame. Thank you for all the joy and pain. Picture show, second bow. was the place we'd meet. Second seat, gold Dutch treat. You were sweet, dark as shame, darling, dark as shame.
The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. The organization that administers a widely used college entrance test called the SAT will change the examination in 2016. The not-for-profit College Board announced that it no longer will test students on rarely used words. Students also will not be required to provide a written work called an essay, and the new SAT will include passages from American historical documents or from writings on issues like freedom and human rights. The SAT is one of two major tests for entrance to American colleges and universities. The other test is called the ACT. Test scores help colleges decide if a candidate can succeed at their schools. More than 2 million students take the SAT yearly. They include about 100,000 foreign students. Nigerian student Peace Umaro is in her first year at Howard University in Washington, D.C. Ms. Umaro says she thinks the new tests will be easier because of the removal of rarely used words. She says that is the hardest part for international students. The College Board says words on the new test will relate to usage. Students will be asked to identify the meaning of words based on the way they are used in reading passages. Eddie West is with the National Association for College Admission Counseling. He says the new tests will better predict a student's performance in college.
Personally, I feel like the changes are moving the test in a more positive direction, insofar as they link up with skills and abilities that students will need to succeed, not just in getting into a college or university, but in succeeding once there.
But Mr. West says the addition of material related to American historical documents could make the test harder for international students.
It's going to be relatively uncommon for an international student to be really conversant with the Declaration of Independence or Martin Luther King Jr.'s work or anything else along those lines that might be cited in the test.
Jamaican Shanique Campbell is a second-year student at Howard University. She called the new material very scary for international students.
We're already faced with knowing that we're taking an American-based exam. And so there are a lot of things that we are not prepared for in terms of what to expect on that exam, cultural references that we won't be able to identify with.
Bob Schaefer of the National Center for Fair and Open Testing spoke to VOA by Skype.
Students from other countries, particularly those who did not grow up learning English, are at a double disadvantage. The test is in a foreign language for them, and they didn't get test prep, so it's harder.
But the College Board says it has formed a free online educational service. Khan Academy will provide preparation material linked to the newly designed SAT. And that's the VOA Learning English Education Report. For more news of education and for podcasts, captioned videos, and lessons to test your English skills, visit our website at learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Geraldine Watson.
From VOA Learning English. Welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning American English. I'm Steve Ember. Last time, we talked about Martin Van Buren. He was sworn in as the 8th President of the United States in 1837. Not long after he took office, the United States suffered an economic depression. It lasted 6 years. The depression was the major problem during Van Buren's presidency, but not the only problem. In foreign affairs, one of the chief problems Van Buren faced was a dispute with Britain about Canada. Canadian rebels had tried twice to end British rule over Canada. They failed both times. Rebel leaders fled to safety in the United States. There, they found it easy to get men and supplies to help them continue their struggle. The rebels built a base on a Canadian island in the Niagara River, which formed part of the border between the two countries. The rebels used an American boat to carry supplies from the American side to their base. In December 1837, Canadian soldiers crossed the Niagara River and seized the boat. One American was killed in the fight. For a while, Canadian forces and the rebels exchanged attacks. A number of American citizens assisted the rebels. President Van Buren was troubled. He declared that the wish to help others become independent was a natural feeling among Americans. But he said no American had a right to invade a friendly country. He warned that citizens who fought against the Canadian government and were captured could expect no help from the United States. Another problem between the United States and Canada at that time concerned the border along the American state of Maine. That part of the border had been in dispute ever since 1783. That was when Britain finally recognized the independence of the United States. Years later, the King of the Netherlands agreed to decide the dispute. The king said it was impossible to decide the border from the words of the peace treaty between Britain and the United States. So he proposed what he believed was a fair settlement instead. The United States would get about twice as much of the disputed area as Canada. Britain accepted the proposal, but the United States did not. The United States refused because the state of Maine would not accept it. In 1838, Britain withdrew its acceptance of the proposal. Canadians entered the disputed area. The governor of Maine sent state militia forces to the area. The soldiers drove out the Canadians and built forts. Canada, too, began to prepare for war. President Van Buren sent General Winfield Scott to Maine. Scott was able to get the governor to withdraw his forces from the disputed area. He also received guarantees that Canadian forces would not enter the area. The danger of war passed. Americans in the border area, however, were angry with President Van Buren. They believed he was weak because he did not want war. The president was losing support, not only in the Northeast. People all over the country were suffering because of the Depression. Most people believed Van Buren was responsible for their troubles, because he continued the hard money policies of former President Andrew Jackson. Historian Joel Silby is an expert on Martin Van Buren. He says most historians do not think Van Buren was a strong president. However, Joel Silby says Van Buren left an important legacy.
When it comes to the political system, he was a brilliant innovator.
Van Buren organized his political party, the group that came to be known as the Democrats. In the late 18th and early 19th centuries, people who supported independent farmers and states' rights over a central government generally followed Thomas Jefferson. They called themselves Democratic Republicans or Jeffersonian Republicans. Jeffersonian Republicans opposed the Federalist Party. They believed the Federalists wanted a strong national government, a powerful banking system, and a small elite social class. But after Thomas Jefferson died, the Jeffersonian Republicans broke into factions. They divided their support among several candidates during presidential elections, and as a result, often lost. Joel Silby says one of the things Van Buren had learned was that above all else, when you have an ideology you want to fight for, you need unity. Van Buren organized political clubs and political leaders in New York that all supported Jefferson's ideas. He brought them together to talk about their political beliefs and choose a single candidate for their party. In the 1828 election, Van Buren had expanded this organization. His insistence on political unity had helped elect Andrew Jackson. And his system of meetings eventually became the national conventions that political parties use today to officially nominate their candidates. Van Buren also helped create the modern political campaign. In the 1820s, he noticed many state constitutions were lifting some of their voting restrictions. As a result, more people were allowed to vote. Historian Joel Silby says Van Buren wanted to bring these new voters into his political party.
He borrowed from a couple of minor parties the notion of popular campaigns where you persuaded people through campaign rallies, speeches by prominent people, and on election day, getting them out to vote by your organization's agents.
Joel Silby explains that these techniques to persuade and mobilize voters were new to national politics. Now they are some of the major features of political campaigns. Martin Van Buren's political tactics earned him a few nicknames. Some called him the Little Magician, because he knew how to win elections. Others called him the Sly Fox of Kinderhook. Kinderhook is the town in New York where Van Buren grew up. The term Sly Fox is not entirely positive. Joel Silby says the nickname suggests that many people did not feel they could trust him.
Van Buren is the first person to be seen as that, a manipulator. Unfairly, I said he would do anything to win an election, and he had no real principles.
However, Joel Silby says Van Buren did what he thought was necessary to preserve Jefferson's ideals. In the election of 1840, Van Buren ran for a second term as president. This time, his opponents used Van Buren's political skills against him. Joel Silby says the Whigs used popular speeches and rallies to portray Van Buren as a failed president.
During his reelection campaign in 1840, crowds of Whigs would chant, "Matty Van is a used-up man," because he no longer had any power or effect on things.
The Whigs also nominated a military hero they believed the people would love. He was General William Henry Harrison. Harrison had led an attack on Indians in the Indiana Territory in 1811. Many people believed that the battle at a place called Tippecanoe was a great victory for Harrison. But Van Buren's party, the Democrats, spoke of the 67-year-old Harrison as an old lady. They called him Granny Harrison. One Democratic newspaper said the old man did not really want to be president. It said Harrison would be happier with a $2,000 a year pension, a barrel of hard apple cider to drink, and a log cabin to live in. Hard apple cider was a popular drink among working men, and at that time, a great many farmers still lived in log cabins, houses made of rough logs. The Whigs were the party of bankers and businessmen. They saw a chance to use the Democrats' statement to their own gain. It gave them a way to present themselves as the party of the working man and the small farmer. "The statement is right," they cried. "The Whig Party is the party of hard cider and log cabins." The Whigs put up log cabins everywhere and offered free hard cider to everyone. They organized huge outdoor meetings for thousands with food and drink for all. They held parades and marched with flags, bands, and pictures of William Henry Harrison. Many campaign songs were written. These songs told of Harrison's bravery against the Indians. They told how he loved the hard and simple life of the common man, even though he was really a Virginia aristocrat. The Democrats made their own claims. They said Harrison could not read or write. They said he would not pay people the money he owed them. And they charged that Harrison even sold white men into slavery. Senator Henry Clay said the campaign was a struggle between log cabins and palaces, between hard cider and champagne. The state of Maine held elections in September of 1840. Voters in Maine elected a Whig, Edward Kent, as governor. They gave the state's electoral votes to Harrison, celebrated as the hero of Tippecanoe, and to his vice presidential candidate, John Tyler. The election results produced a new song for the Whigs, "And Have You Heard the News from Maine and What Old Maine Can Do?" She went hell-bent for Governor Kent, and Tippecanoe and Tyler too.
"Then let them talk about hard cider, 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 and log cabins too. It will only help to speed the ball for Tippecanoe and Tyler too, for Tippecanoe and Tyler too. And with them will beat little Van, 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 Van. Oh, he's a used-up man, and with them will beat little Van."
One by one, the other states voted. The election was close in the popular vote, but Harrison received 234 electoral votes compared to only 60 for Van Buren. And so William Henry Harrison became the 9th president of the United States. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.